I remind you, this is a live call-in show, so if you're in the Phoenix area and you want to call in with a question or a comment, the number is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. If you're listening via the Internet, which I know some of you are because I get your emails occasionally, it's also a toll number, same number, 480-949-1310. Be glad to take your calls along the way. Now, if you've been listening to the show for the last few weeks, actually the few weeks before the election, you know that being a Kerry supporter, that I dedicated four shows to getting the word out on the election and particularly on the issues surrounding electing John Kerry as president. And if you are anywhere near conscious, you know that John Kerry was not elected president on November 2nd. And I also believe in teaching closure. So today's show basically is about closure in whatever way we can reach it. And the title of today's show is When an Election Does Not Go Your Way. Now, if you've listened to the show before over the last 3 years, you know I've done a number of shows about current events and how they impact our emotions. And a number of people have asked me, you know, what does a mental health show have to do with politics? Why was I going that way with those two shows? Well, if you go to my website, which is tellthetruthfaster.com, there is a page with articles that I've written over the number of years. And after the 2000 election, I kind of tongue-in-cheek titled an article DSM-4-000-0.00 called Election-Related Depression, a New Diagnostic Code for the DSM-4. And I'd like to open the show by quoting the last paragraph in there. As I opened the article, I quoted a civil rights activist who was a friend of Martin Luther King Jr.'s named Bayard Rustin. And the quote was, "History is not an accident. History is a choice." And in my last paragraph of that article, I write, "It is events in our clients' lives that drive them to seek therapy. Those events could be personal, childhood abuse, death of a loved one, history of addictions, and so many other things that scar and damage the psyche, the heart, the mind, and the soul. Despite Bayard Rustin's statement that history is not an accident, that history is not a choice in a practical sense, history as choice is the conscious decisions we make today that is creating our future history. The powers that be in Florida and the Supreme Court, I believe, let us down. We have a system that really does work, even if it loses its way from time to time. We have minds and hearts that really can take care of us, even if they lose their way from time to time. As therapists, we are there to be conscious lights to help people rediscover their way, whatever that may be. As human beings, part of a society, I feel I have a similar charge." End quote. So that is kind of my motivation for using airtime like this to support political means, because there is no separating, I believe, our emotions from the politics of our culture and society. There's no way to separate the reactions we have from things like an election. This past week has been Thanksgiving, but this past week was also, I think, the 41st anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. That was a shared natural grief, one that I remember living through at age 13 or 14. I was in junior high school, and I remember how the nation was glued to the television sets. I remember when the Challenger and Columbia shuttles, there was a shared national grief. 9/11, a shared national grief. But when we have something like an election, there's a shared grief and a shared celebration by separate groups. People who were expecting or hoping for their candidate to win, and they didn't, have a grieving process to complete, maybe some anger, maybe disappointment, but it also connects with our own personal history of how we've dealt with or not dealt with emotional traumas or griefs in our lives. We have another group of people that are celebrating. And those group of people sometimes may not have a real healthy way of celebrating, but they won the election. They have a right to celebrate. And yet it's very hard for those who were not on the side of the elected president or any election to really feel that joy, and actually it compounds, I think, our grief. So that's the purpose and focus of today's show, to actually bring it down to the human individual need for closure. Because what many of us are feeling may also be piggybacking a lot of personal history with other issues in our lives, and we can't let that go. But it also is about the bigger picture, and that's when we get to my guest today. My guest today is Miguel Bustos, who ran for supervisor for the 9th District in San Francisco and lost the election to an incumbent, Tom Amiano. And Miguel has a master's degree in political science, so he takes in the bigger picture. It's very closely related. I have a bachelor's in sociology with a minor in psych and psychology, and there's so much overlapping between political science and sociology. I mean, it's hard to separate the two. But I'm going to be relying on his expertise in political science as well as his own personal experience. Now, he also has a very deep connection to the Clinton Gore administration, because he was an aide to Mrs. Gore in a lot of ways. I'm going to have him talk about some of those things. Miguel, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, welcome to the show, and I hope you got to listen to that opening.
I did. Thank you so much.
And first of all, I know that you probably have a lot to react to in terms of your own campaign as well as what went on a national level. What's your reaction to the things that I said in the opening about what it feels like to actually run and lose your own campaign? What are the things that you're dealing with and you're working on in terms of getting past it and through that?
Well, there's a lot of similarities, because in the sense of me as a candidate, and as well as people who were volunteers or as people who were looking at the national election, basically what you have is a lot of hope. And you have hope that things will go your way, but when they don't, then it affects us all basically the same way. One of the things that happened on, first of all, just to let everyone know, we ran a very, very good campaign. District 9 is part of the Mission District of San Francisco, which is a predominantly Latino community, includes Bernal Heights, which is, there's a large lesbian gay population there, and the Portola area, which is a large Asian population. I was born and raised in this district. I actually live in the same house that I grew up in.
Wow.
And so for me, running for this seat was not just running for a seat, it was running for my home, for my community. So there's deep roots that I had, that I still have in this district, that sort of made it very, very meaningful to me. Historically, this community has been neglected by the city and county of San Francisco. We never got the services that we needed. We have our schools that are not even complete. For example, Don O'Connell High School, which is one of our only high schools in the district, it's 67% complete, and it's been open for 5 years. So it's basic quality of life issues that I was focusing on. The fact that the community finally had someone who was from the community running, I cannot tell you how excited people got, how the hopes and the dreams of a lot of people, especially a lot of our elders in the community, were right there. And so we ran a campaign that was exciting. We ran a campaign that was motivating. We ran a campaign that really, really got the attention of a lot of people. Tom came into the election after I had already filed. He was running for mayor when I filed my papers. So we didn't start this election to go against the incumbent. it was sort of the perception of the general population that he was termed out and he was running for mayor. You know, he didn't win the mayor's race, and you know, now we have Gavin Newsom, and so, you know, I'm sorry he didn't win the mayor's race, but we should not have been a consolation prize.
Mm-hmm.
He had been our district supervisor for 10 years, and nothing happened. So for a lot of people, there was a lot of hope that change was coming, similar to what happened in 92 when Governor Clinton was running. There was a lot of hope that change was going to happen. Now we have a situation where we, you know, I've been telling people we should have just not had an election because everything stayed the same.
Mm-hmm.
We have George Bush and we have Tom Amiano. Not to say that they're both the same, but, you know, it's just the status quo won in this election. Right after our election, or after the tallies came in, it was really interesting because a reporter came into our campaign headquarters and commented to me that he had just finished coming from Tom's party and that there was hardly anybody there. It was very subdued and it was very quiet. And he won. And he had come to then our campaign party and we had people lining out in the streets doing the conga line. We had music. We had about 200 people in our campaign headquarters. We had people on the streets because they didn't fit. There was a lot of joy and excitement. Now, granted, a lot of the people who were close to me, many broke down. Many, you know, cried on my shoulders because they had worked so hard. Because this campaign from the very beginning was not about Miguel. And it wasn't about Tom. It was about community. It was about bringing some change. So, and I had always said throughout the campaign, it's not my election. It's our election. So a lot of the hopes that were sort of broken or people were devastated, if they looked to me and, what you know, they're like, well, what now? And my whole reaction or my response to a lot of the people was that we move forward. You know, I was reading some of the articles, and I know a lot of the folks, because I did get a chance to travel a bit right after the election, telling me how upset they were. And to me, you know, going back to the quote of that, you know, history is not an accident, it's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from my perspective and what I told people, we don't have time to be depressed. We do not have time. We need to get up and we need to march on. It seems that the hopes and the dreams and the excitement and the action of trying to create change comes once every 4 years. And that's the problem. It only comes once every 4 years. You know, that's when you see the politicians coming around. That's when you see people get excited, get involved. We need, after the election, we need to get involved. We need to not be depressed. And we need to be hopeful that we're going to help create that change. You know, a lot of people think that a candidate or a party will be the ones doing it. No, that doesn't happen. It's about us. It's about the individuals making a difference within their own communities and their own lives. You know, we do not have time to be depressed. We need to march on.
Well, taking it to the national level with it, because I think your point is very well taken. I think after the 2000 election, because of the shock and because of the way it unfolded, it was hard for me, and I know a lot of other people, that for 4 years there was still this disbelief that things were happening to our culture and society and in the world because of a disenfranchisement and other things. And I don't want to necessarily dwell on that. Even in that article that I wrote that's on my website, I said even back in 2000, if there had been a clear majority, both electoral and popular vote, as much as I disliked Bush being elected, he would have been my president because this is a democracy that we live in. But that wasn't the case in 2000. And in all honesty, my little rebellion was, for 4 years I never used the word president and Bush in the same breath. Now I have to, because it was an electoral victory as well as a populist victory. There's a different energy about this. There's, I think, a greater disappointment, because I think many of us felt like this was a chance to correct the thing that went on 4 years ago. But now there is, okay, there's something clear here. We may not like it. We may not have felt it was a real positive campaign, which I don't think it was anyway. Mm-hmm. But now's the time to get active and to focus. So what do we do on a national level? I mean, he's acting like this is a mandate when it was like less than 2% difference in the vote. What do we do to kind of deal with our emotional stuff in terms of self-empowerment? This is how the therapy stuff gets back into this and the mental health issue. What do you suggest? I know on a local level you have some really good ideas even on your website. But what do you suggest as a national consciousness, or the people in Phoenix listening or whatever, to really get past and to empower themselves?
Well, one, we got to get connected. There's a lot of talk. I mean, I just came last week. I was in Little Rock, Arkansas for the opening of President Clinton's library. And it was an opportunity for us for me mainly was not only to see the library, but to see a lot of my old colleagues that used to work with at the White House. And you know, we got a chance to go through the library, and you know, it's really 8 years of accomplishments. And there's a little movie you see before you start the tour, and it was really interesting and very sad, because I was with a coworker of mine. We're sitting next to each other, and in this movie that you see before you start the tour, you have world leaders talking about how wonderful President Clinton was as an ambassador to the U.S. They show images of people in Africa waving the American flag, people in different other countries waving the American flag during some of the presidential visits. It was so incredible. And my coworker began to cry. And I got touched, because in 4 years we've come so far. It was like that time was so long ago of when people liked us, and when we had a domestic policy agenda, when we had a great international agenda where we made friends rather than made enemies. But what it did for me, going through that and seeing how far we've gone, is that we need to create change locally, but we got to do it by getting connected to people, getting connected to other people. You know, I hear a lot of people saying, well, I'm upset, I'm this, I'm that, or I don't know what to do, or, you know, I'm angry. You know, we need to stop thinking of just us, because in that case, it becomes overwhelming. We need to begin to think that we are connected to other people, and that we need to build those spheres of influence. We need to make friends who may be sitting across the aisle and talk to them and engage them and begin to bring people into the fold. I mean, the conservatives have done a great job of doing that. You know, they've done a great job of capturing language that says, you know, it's about our family values. You know, they don't say it's my family value. They say it's our family values. Well, they're not the only ones that have the monopoly on family values.
Right.
And that's why I think that what we need to do as individuals is to go and reach out and start talking with people, start working with people, start doing things for people. You know, like I said, you know, it seems that every 4 years this stuff comes around. But what are we really talking about as people who want to create change, people who want to move our country in a positive direction? You know, we're really talking about, you know, right now we have sort of a two-party system. You know, we have Democrats. We have those who have, and they help for those who don't have. And we have Republicans, those who have and those who want more. So for me, it's about what can I do today to reach out to other people, to get them engaged. So, because remember, it's the people who vote. Right? They're the ones that are going to go out and vote. On election day, the parties, you know, the political machinery, that stops. It's at that point, you've got to leave it up to the people.
Well, how do you get past? Because I think and I feel, that both sides of the aisle have spent the last year or more demonizing the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this has been one of the most divisive elections I've seen in my life. I'm 50. I'm going to be 55 in January, and I have voted in every primary and every election, with the exception of one where I thought I'd be back in time, back to New York in time, and didn't get an absentee ballot. So, you know, I'm a voter, but I've never, ever seen an election that has divided the nation as much as this national election, and where both sides basically have been demonizing each other. I mean, as a gay man, I remember back in the 70s living in South Florida and working at a drug abuse treatment program in West Palm Beach, and a very close friend and coworker and his wife were born-again Christians, and when I was getting out of a hospital and a house that I was having built wasn't ready yet, they took me into their home, moved their young child, into his son, into their daughter's room to give me a bedroom. And at a certain point, I said to George, I mean, you know I'm a gay man. You bring me into your home. You're a born-again Christian. And there is such a darkness and sense of rejection I get from so many people. And yet all I feel from you, excuse me, is unconditional love and total friendship and acceptance and embracing me into your home with your children and stuff that just feels like so contradictory to what I see in everyone else. And, you know, he turned to me and he said, Stuart, I love you, and my wife loves you, and my kids love you, and we know that you're gay, and while we may not understand it or agree with it, and in our own teachings feel it's a sin, our way of reacting to that is to love you, and we pray for you every night. I did not take offense to that. I thought it was one of the sweetest, warmest way of bonding with someone where I'm honoring their viewpoints and their belief systems, and they're honoring who I am as a human being and expressing that unconditional love outward. But that's not what's been going on in this country. You know, it's like such a divisive thing that if you're Republican and or conservative, if you're a fundamentalist Christian, it's almost as if, you know, it's a devil and angel type of thing from whichever perspective you're looking at. How do we get past that demonizing that seems to have gone on lately?
Well, we really have to begin with our own lives. I mean, you know, if me as one individual, I cannot conquer the entire world and say we need to stop demonizing each other.
Mm-hmm.
However, as an individual, and now as someone who has run for elected office, you know, your sphere of influence grows a bit. I can do it with the people that I interact with. Those people then will do it with those people who they interact with. You know, it does not happen overnight. And I know, you know, we're in a society where it's all about quick fix. Let's get things done right now and make it happen now. But, you know, that's just not going to happen. And so we need to start with our own spheres of influence. And you know what? And we should not always be preaching to the choir.
Mm-hmm.
We need to make it a point to go outside of our safety zone and go out and talk to other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I happen to know some Republicans, and I happen to know some born-again Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And me, as a gay Latino in San Francisco, California, you know, for some people, you know, they've met me, and they see who I am. I mean, Maya Angelou talks about, you know, one of her poems, she says, we are more like my friends than we are unlike.
And say that again, I didn't hear it.
We are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike.
Okay.
And people tend to look at sort of the national or leadership, identified leadership for direction, and those are the ones that are demonizing everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And we forget that, you know, you don't have to be an elected person or a bishop or a high person in your community to be a leader. Every single one of us has that opportunity to be that leader in our community, in our families. I mean, the fact that, you know, my brothers had somewhat of a difficult time about me coming out. And, you know, one of my nephews had made a derogatory remark, called someone a faggot. And my brother then stopped him and said, hey, you don't do that. And that changed my brother's perspective on things. he became a leader now in his family.
Mm-hmm.
So now, I mean, I'm as open as you can get, and, you know, my family's fine with it. But it took people to, in their own spheres of influence to make it grow out. So now there's a new generation of young people who are more accepting of it. In the same way in everything else in life, you know, one thing that we cannot take out of this conversation is that the reason why we want some change is because there are people out there that are suffering. There are people out there that are in need. There are kids that need classrooms. There are families that need food and shelter.
Mm-hmm.
There are people out there that need jobs. And we got to make sure that those faces of those people are at the forefront of all our conversations about this, because it's for those people that we're trying to work hard for the sense of change. And so when I say that, you know, we need to connect with some of those people, because people are struggling every day. And you know, I have the luxury of having a house. And although, you know, now that the election's over, I'm about to find a job. But I have the luxury to even take time to look for one. And so, you know, what I'm always challenging people is that, you know, you got to reach out to people. You got to get connected to folks so that, you know what, you have firsthand knowledge of why we're trying to create change.
Mm-hmm.
You have firsthand knowledge and you know people who need the help that we need to give them when we create that change in terms of administration, whether at the national or the local level, or even within our own community.
You know, one thing that I always teach, you know, in terms of healing, when people are looking at too big a picture at a time, I say basically the same thing in therapeutic terms to people. The peace on the planet will start by finding peace within yourself first. And that if you can heal your own demons, instead of looking to others as the demon, if you can heal the pain, the anger, the sadness that you have, that the little kid inside of us is still struggling with, if you can find peace within all that you've gone through, then there's a little more peace on the planet.
That's right.
People are going to be attracted to you because they're going to want to know how you got that. And then you become a teacher. And I think it's exactly what you're saying, because it's the same healing process on a personal and psychological and spiritual level. And the reality of it is, no matter what our political party, no matter what our religious teachings are, I believe all religious teachings say, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you.
That's right.
And, you know, we are our brother's keepers. So it means getting out there and solving the problems in your own community or in your own home to start, and reaching out for help where it's needed. And I think that's what you're saying very clearly, is that's how we bring community together. Instead of looking at the differences, we look at how we're alike.
That's right.
And what our basic common needs are that we can work together on solving. Instead of trying to tackle the big problems, we start with the ones that in many people's lives are big problems. They don't have food, they don't have clothing, they don't
right.
have shelter.
And that's how we get connected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really about approach. You know, I left about 2 days after the election. I left to go to Thailand. I chose to go to Thailand because I wanted to go to a Buddhist country.
Mm-hmm.
I left a little bitter because, you know, there's a lot of disappointments.
Mm-hmm.
But I came back grateful. I had to go and be in a place and find a perspective to look at this whole experience of running for office.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back grateful that I ran. I came back grateful that we did a lot of good things. And I shared with you the letter I sent out to my supporters.
Mm-hmm.
And on election night, you know, we won in many levels. We may not have won the election, but we got a community that was excited. We had young people involved with our campaign. You know, we had elders come into our office saying how proud they were of me, having seen me grow up. You know, in many levels we won. And to me, we got to look at a very holistic approach, and that's why I'm really excited about what you're doing, because you have to look at it holistically.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Tony Robbins, who, as you know, is an incredible speaker
right.
and a motivational coach, he talks about how when you when you're grateful, when you think about things that you're grateful for, you smile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's true. You could be upset and mad, but once you start thinking about things that you're grateful for, a smile comes to your face.
Yeah, one of the tools that I often give clients and that I do myself from time to time is basically writing a gratitude list.
Yeah.
It's good to remind us, but it's also good to be able to pull it out from time to time as a reminder.
Correct.
You know, and it's a great process. I have a question for you that is very personal, and I tend to do this with my guests. How are you different having run this election, having lost the election? How are you different from before you threw your hat in the ring?
I'm a lot wiser. I am a lot stronger. My word is more important to me. People's words are more important to me. And I feel, you know, I think I'm more enriched in the sense of that experience. I did it.
Mm-hmm.
I have more friends. And so I feel like I'm more enriched because of it. And I feel like I proved to myself that, you know what, I was able to do it. You know, again, the Mission District of San Francisco has been a community that, whenever there's no services, you know, the people don't feel empowered. They don't feel a lot of hope. And the fact that, again, one of their own did this,
mm-hmm,
brought hope back into the district. And so I feel very, very good about that.
That's great. You know, I told you when we spoke the other day that one of my guests during those 4 weeks before the election was Stuart Starkey, who was running against John McCain for the Senate seat in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And Stuart is an eighth grade math teacher from, you know, a district in South Phoenix that, you know, there are many challenges for those students. And, you know, in all honesty, he was running a campaign to win. And that's the level of integrity I picked up in him.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I know and most people knew there was no chance of him beating John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
But what came out of that, even in talking to him, even before the end of the election, that I got real clearly is he became an inspiration to those students that really would not have maybe thought about politics in the same way if someone they knew wasn't running. And he became an inspiration and a voice for people that wouldn't have had a voice if there was no Democrat running against John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a real level of integrity. In fact, if I was living and voting in Arizona, I would have voted for him because that's how impressed I was with this, you know, I don't use it pejoratively, this small man from nowhere, an eighth grade school teacher who said, you know what, this is a democracy. Anyone who wants to run can run, and I have something to say, and there needs to be a dialogue. And to me, the key is he was running because there needs to be a dialogue. And that, to me, is so important. That's what democracy is about, and that really, if we look at it, what the elections are about,
mm-hmm,
they get a dialogue going, even if some of the words used are hurtful. If they're candidates of integrity and compassion, then the dialogue can actually be very productive instead of damaging.
Well, you know, I'd gotten, you know, once, you know, I filed my papers in September. Tom came into the race in February and March,
mm-hmm,
and I got a lot of pressure from people to drop out.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you know, you can't do this. You know.
Speak into the mic a little bit louder.
A lot of folks were saying, you know, Miguel, you need to be dropping out. You know, let Tom run this. And I said, it's not about Tom,
mm-hmm,
and it's not about me. It's about bringing the issues up. And, you know, we had another candidate who was running. She sort of runs all the time. And, you know, it was my first time having gone to debates with her and with Tom and with some other folks. And her name is Lucretia, and I actually called her. You know, Lucretia, her focus is more about the immigrant rights community. And, you know, that wasn't my focus, and it wasn't Tom's focus, but I actually called her after one of our debates and just thanked her for bringing the issues up, because it does bring dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, I'm speaking not as a candidate, but as a resident of this district, thank you for bringing those issues up. Some people dismissed her as crazy, but I thought, you know, the fact that she's even bringing them up is good. And that's what democracy is about, and that's exactly what you're saying. And to be able to bring up these different ideas makes us more healthier in our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about these issues, and
right.
We shouldn't be dismissing people.
There's another issue, too, that I think is very important because there's a lot of misunderstanding between groups. Yesterday, I went out to a bookstore and I bought 3 introductory and basic books on Islam. And I bought 2 basic books on evangelical Christianity. I realized at a certain point that I needed to understand what's driving the radicals within those groups, and I needed to understand more of the basic premises and beliefs that they're holding to, because I realized at a certain point I really can't be arguing with them if I don't really know what it is I'm arguing about. And also, I need to find places where I can connect with them and understand and say, you know what, I agree with this stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I think that's along the lines of what you're saying in terms of reaching out to one another instead of just holding your position. The same thing when I'm doing couples counseling. Almost always, the couple, whether it's a gay couple, lesbian couple, straight couple, it doesn't matter, there's a positioning going on.
Yeah.
Neither one of them are willing to get out of their corner. They're just constantly throwing jabs. And when they start listening to each other and understanding each other, there's a softening that goes on. And I bought these books to try and get me to do some softening.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking about how you dealt with all this. And I'm not asking you to divulge anything because I know, you know, you've worked for Tipper Gore and were part of the Clinton-Gore administration. But the 2000 election was particularly difficult.
Uh-huh.
And I think you're in a position in San Francisco, having run now, to have a voice that needs to be taken more seriously and more publicly in implementing changes and influencing the supervisors that were elected. I think John Kerry, going back to the Senate, is in a position knowing that he had over 50-some-odd million votes of people who really did not agree, that he has a constituency behind him, that he has some credibility to go out there and fight for them. I think Al Gore getting the popular vote back in 2000, and however you want to argue about Florida going one way or the other, he chose to kind of, from what it looked like to me, to kind of withdraw, and I'm sure there was a lot of healing he and Tipper needed to do at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But what do politicians like Gore and Kerry, do you think, how do they work through something like this, and where do they fit into the picture after a loss like this?
You know, the vice president is, he's a brilliant man.
Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, I worked for him and look up to him and saw him as a visionary.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very gracious right after the, you know, he announced that he wasn't going to, this is in 2000 before the changeover. I went back and to D.C. and the vice president was having a goodbye party for all the staffers and friends at the White House. And he was so gracious and he said, you know, he said, this is a lesson that we need to learn and we need to move forward. And it for the vice president, I think, you know, he's a very spiritual man. And Mrs. Gore, they're very into their family. And I think for him, he drew his strength from his family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, given that he is a visionary, and given that he is, you know, he now has a national platform.
Mm-hmm.
When he says something, you know, the media picks it up. And, you know, now he's doing his cable. They're going to do their new cable company, which is going to be based out of San Francisco. You know, I think folks like the Vice President and Senator Kerry are always going to be the thorn in the side. And they're always going to be speaking truth on what needs to happen, because they do have a base of support. And knowing those two individuals, they won't be shy from doing that. And that, I think, we need to be grateful for,
mm-hmm.
is that they'll always come out and be a voice and to try to speak truth when the truth is not being spoken.
Mm-hmm. Well, the name of my show is Tell the Truth Faster, and one thing that I've learned a long time ago is truth is relative, and truth is based on your own perspective, and what Vice President Gore and Senator Kerry and myself or you may see as truth, others may not see it as truth.
Mm-hmm.
So I think sometimes it's about knowing in your heart what your truth is and being able to find, like we were saying earlier, a connection to some piece of that truth that you might be able to connect with some piece of someone else's truth that you may be disagreeing with, or they may be disagreeing with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that, you know, when I see Vice President Gore now, there seems to be a sense of peace about him, a sense of softness about him that wasn't necessarily coming through during his campaign. It just seems like when the pressure was off, all of a sudden he softened and he relaxed more, and there seems to be a different energy that's actually even more attractive about him,
mm-hmm.
After that campaign ended. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm kind of seeing, I mean, probably Kerry too. I mean, I think when people are campaigning, and let me know if you were feeling this too, that you're overly cautious about everything you're saying because the media is looking on every word and the opposition is trying to find whatever word they can use for sound bites to knock you down.
That's exactly it. And so you got to be careful with your words and your actions.
Mm-hmm. So with all that, I mean, it must be a very difficult thing to actually make a commitment to run for office, knowing that, and I know it's been written before, that there are a lot of really good people that won't run for public office because they don't want their whole lives to have to be, you know, pulled apart in the media, and, you know, there's no sense of privacy. How do you deal as a candidate or a former candidate, and I get real clearly a future candidate, how do you deal with your life being fodder for whatever anybody wants to use it for?
What was that again? My life being what?
That your life now becomes a target for whatever anybody wants to use it for.
Well, you know, for me, my whole thing is I just got to live. Mm-hmm. And I will not stop living. And I need to be very consistent with the fact that, you know, I'm still going to be in the community. And I'm still going to be out there. And, you know, will more people recognize me? Yeah, there's two more people that may know who I am. But with that, you know, we need to use it. Like, for example, one little kid came up to me one day, or his mother came up to me and said, you know, are you Miguel Bustos? And I told her mom, yeah. She said, oh, my son wanted to say hello. And you know, again, we're talking about a very local election. But, you know, I turned to the little boy, went, got down on my knees, and I said, well, I need your help. And the fact that he looked at me and said, you need my help? I said, yeah, I need your help to win. And, you know, what we need to do is always empower other people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we have a base of support, you know, people have said, well, in 4 years, and you know, who knows in 4 years, but, you know, we do have a base of support now.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a new group of people that have been empowered and have learned that, you know what, this was their campaign as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people in our campaign that had never worked on anything political before. And I was proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's like, you know, we're out there and, you know, we still need to speak truth. And you know, I read, when I was a graduate student, I read Mahatma Gandhi's autobiography, you know, just his experiences with truth. And truth doesn't necessarily mean right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's your reality, your enlightenment. And for me, you know, we need to always look at that. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, we can't always look at everyone being the enemy and sort of go where people are. And then once you get there, ask them to come where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, now that, you know, in San Francisco, people are looking and saying, well, you know, they're looking at me as someone who's going to run again. And whether I run again or not, we need to still bring up the needs of the community.
Right.
And use that base of support to empower people to speak up for themselves.
Mm-hmm. You said something earlier when you said after the election you chose Thailand because it was a Buddhist country, and I want to get back to that. What was the importance of it being a Buddhist country for you?
I needed to find some peace. I needed to go somewhere where, you know, I wasn't out there really sightseeing, but more like finding myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that was key. You know, I mentioned that, you know, I left somewhat bitter and upset and disappointed by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be that way.
Right.
And so I went somewhere that I thought that I could then, you know, be able to go to some temples and sit there and observe and meditate. And, you know, like I said, I came back grateful for the experience, for the friends, for the truth that I experienced throughout the process.
Yeah. Well, actually, I kind of resonated with that because my experience of Buddhism is it tends to be a bit more inclusive and less judgmental and more about your own inner soul and your own sense of connection, almost more of a Native American type of approach to spirituality and connectedness to nature and spirit.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of what I got out of that. Before we close, I want to read two paragraphs from that article from my website again. And to me, it's relevant because it was about my own journey back in the late 60s, early 70s. And I think it's a bit of what's happened today in this election when you talked about so many young people and first-time voters. So I'm quoting this is, in the fall of 1968, I remember being a naive and true American. I remember being a freshman at Harper College, now Binghamton University in New York, and defending my government and my president because I was raised to believe that they would always tell the truth and that the system always worked. We had a right and just purpose to be in Vietnam because we were told this by our government. I remember standing in the dorm lounge arguing with a 6'4" militant sophomore named John and thinking he was crazy to be that agitated and opinionated. This was the time of turmoil in our country, civil rights, women's rights, students trying to teach our elders as much as learn from our professors, and in 1969, Stonewall occurred. It was a time of activism for many, but for me, always the cautious one, I watched and felt uneasy. I began to feel things that frightened me, but I am grateful to have been a part of history that molded my sense of conscience and taught me what was possible when the cause is just and my heart finally screams out at a volume that I cannot ignore. I try now to listen to my heart even when the voice is quieter. I have learned that my heart is always right and that my head understands that it must find a way to follow through on my heart's urgings. It took many semesters and the invasion of Cambodia to get me to finally listen to my heart and march, protest, hand out flyers to the workers at IBM in Endicott, New York. I marched to Albany for gay rights. I attended rallies. I was angry and scared of my anger and scared for my country. I remember doing this not as a leader, but as a timid man still afraid that I was doing something bad. There was a power in these actions that came from within that was unfamiliar to me, but it felt good. End quote. And to me, it's that last sentence. There was a power in these actions that came from within that was unfamiliar to me, but it felt good. And to me, I think that if good things are to come out of the political situation in this country, it's about individual empowerment. It's about listening to one's heart. It's about getting to those things that you feel have integrity and feel right for you and not being afraid of them so long as you're acting on them from a place of compassion and integrity and you're moving forward, whether you win or lose an election. Okay. What's your thoughts on what I just read and how that impacts the youth of today?
I think it's right on. The only thing I would add is that, you know, you're moved with others. Because that's how, you know, we're not an island unto ourselves, and so we need to connect with people. And so be empowered and be uplifted to stand up for what just happened this past November and connect with others to really build that movement of integrity, that movement of truth, and that movement of trying to say, okay, look, we're in this together. We need to move forward. But to act, that's key, and to find that power to act.
One last question.
Mm-hmm.
You and I live in California.
Yep.
Which obviously voted for Kerry, and our legislature is basically Democratic, even though our government, no matter what we feel about that recall election or whatever, is a so-called moderate Republican. We live in a state where people tend to be working together on a different level. A state where there may be disagreement, but not the, from my experience, the black and white divisiveness that may be occurring in other states and other communities and stuff. How do you speak to that, to those people who are living in those regions where there may be such a bigger divisiveness or imbalance between Republican, conservative, or moderate, you know, fundamental?
You know, I just really challenge people not to let ideology or miles separate them. And, you know, Arizona is such a large state and people are sort of separated by miles. You know, if you don't let that stop you, you know, reach out with the people and again, you know, make friends. And, that's the way, you know, I told Elizabeth Birch, who used to be the head of the Human Rights Campaign, you know, in order for the gay movement to have friends, we need to be friends. And so, you know, whenever people try to bring up these black and white issues, break that down and say, wait a minute, we're here together. We're walking the same planet. Let's get to the sort of the fundamentals first, and then let's build upon that.
Good. Good point. Miguel, I really want to thank you for taking the time today to be on the show and, you know, do a little piece of the closure work that I really feel is very important for all of us so that we can move forward and learn to talk and work together and walk together with our neighbors and our neighbors in other states, no matter what our political beliefs. So thank you very much for your commitment to your own work and for taking time to be on the show today.
Thank you.
And I want to thank all of you for listening today. And again, if you want to hear this, it'll be archived within the week on my website, tellthetruthfaster.com. If you want to get in touch with myself or Miguel Bustos, you can do it through that website or go to www.miguelbustos.com. And I want to thank you all for listening and pray for the healing that we're all striving for. And happy Thanksgiving to all of you. That I heard of love. One.